The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you
tell me over and over and over.
Trying to say, and can't you feel the fears that I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you
tell me over and over and over again, my friend, how you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
All the hate there is in Red China, and take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here before days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace.
Coming to you from the Richmond Riding Academy secret headquarters of the world's greatest superhero non-team, this is the fourth Long Box Graveyard Podcast. I am Paul O'Connor, and for the next hour or so, I'll tell you what is new at my Long Box Graveyard blog, and also bring you this month's feature, which is a unique look at Frank Miller's Holy Terror. And I do mean a unique look, as we will be striving to see this controversial work through the eyes of a young man who has grown up in a post-9/11 world, rather than the viewpoint of a 50-year-old comic book fart like your humble narrator. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If this is your first time listening, you should know that this podcast is an adjunct to my blog at www.longboxgraveyard.com, where I publish a new column every Wednesday about comic books, usually superhero comics from the Bronze and Silver Ages. The blog is well into its second year of weekly publication, and it's growing every day. I invite you to join me at www.longboxgraveyard.com, where I also welcome your comments. For my returning listeners, thanks for coming back, and your numbers are growing. Mo Christensen of We Talk Comics Podcast has provided some numbers, which I'd like to share with you. Mo has given me both downloads and views numbers for the podcast. It seems that views consistently exceed downloads by about 2-1, so I'm just talking about downloads here. The Long Box Graveyard Podcast is showing steady growth. My downloads for show number 2 are up about 7% over show number 1, and show number 3 was up 20% over show number 2, so we certainly like that trend. Mo tells me he's happy with the numbers, and thus so am I. Even more encouraging is the show is showing some legs. It's continuing to draw downloads even after an episode debuts. So just a little less than 40% of the downloads for my first month's show came in months 2 and 3, which indicates new listeners are continuing to find the podcast and either jumping off in the beginning or going back to review early shows. And that's a very flattering, very gratifying, so thank you. I hope you continue to listen to the Long Box Graveyard Podcast. Tell your friends about the show. And I always take pains to point out, I'm eager to hear your feedback about how I can improve the show going forward. I'm new at this. I appreciate your patience as I explore this new communications form. It was nice to get some feedback on last month's podcast, both by email and on Twitter. You can find me there as at LBoxGraveyard. I have at least indirect evidence that last month's Digital Comics rant reached the halls of DC Comics, and I engaged in a nice Twitter exchange with a member of the Comixology platform over their Digital Comics initiative. You can see a summary of that at the Longbox Graveyard blog if you like. Anyway, it's nice to know that my ideas have been heard. I welcome continuing debate on digital comics. But this month, it's all about Holy Terror, so let's get on with it. First, with a look at what looms ahead at the Longbox Graveyard. The news. We publish a new blog every week at Longbox Graveyard, www.longboxgraveyard.com. Comes out on Wednesdays, which at least used to be New Comic Day. On Wednesday, September 19th, the blog will be Dread 2D. This is timed to coincide with the release of the new Judge Dredd movie, which, no pun intended, I have been dreading. I've had my heart broken in the past by these kind of mid-to-low-budget superhero pictures. Longtime readers of my blog will know I ranted extensively about both last year's Conan the Barbarian and this year's John Carter, which was anything but low-budget, but also a disappointment. But man, the reviews coming out of the UK for this film are stellar, so whether I like it or not, my expectations are edging up. The blog, of course, will be about the comic book Judge Dredd, and I'm far from an expert on Dredd. My experience of the book is limited to a relatively narrow slice of reprints that I read in the 1980s, but man, I love those books, and I'm quite a fan of Judge Dredd. So join me at the blog on the 19th of September for Dredd 2D as we look at the comic book roots of what we hope will be a great comic book film coming up. On the 26th of September, we'll have the Guide to Comic Books on Pinterest, which I hope will be more exciting than it sounds. Pinterest is a new social image sharing service, which I've been using at Longbox Graveyard to archive my images. I'll tell you what Pinterest is all about, how it works, tell you about how it applies to what I do at Longbox Graveyard, also give you the names of some users and pinboards you can check out that have some terrific comic book images. So check that out, the Guide to Comic Books on Pinterest. On the 3rd of October will be my first review of Master of Kung Fu, the 1970s era martial arts comic from Marvel Comics. I'll be looking just at a very brief run of issues, I think issues number 29 to 31, a story called Snowbuster. It's the first of what I hope will be several blogs looking at Master Kung Fu, which is really one of my very favorite books in the 70s, and strangely, even though I'm by this point will be 70 blogs into the weekly Longbox Graveyard, I haven't discussed it yet at the blog, but it really is one of the reasons I started Longbox Graveyard, was to talk about Master of Kung Fu, so I'm finally getting around to it. I hope it'll prove worth the wait. Master of Kung Fu at Longbox Graveyard on the 3rd of October. And then on the 10th of October will be my review of the book Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howe. This book will be published that week. The publisher very kindly sent me an advance copy to read in preparation for this review. It's a terrific book. I'm not tipping my hand by telling you that. I've been enthusing about it on Twitter for the last month or 6 weeks or so. It's a real snapshot about the business and cultural side of comics and really kind of takes you inside the bullpen and gives you a blow-by-blow of how Marvel developed from a funny book publisher to maybe the world's foremost intellectual property vault and movie studio, with Avengers pushing $1.5 billion worth of box office. And of course, the irony is that Marvel was worthless at various points, literally bankrupt and very nearly out of business. So it's a terrific look at that. I'll give you my full review on the 10th. And that'll bring us around to another podcast, which will probably be about technology and how it shaped the storytelling form, technology and business, and how they impact the actual form of storytelling through comics. But that's a month away. I should also say early next month, on the first Wednesday of the month, I'll have a new dollar box column over at StashMyComics.com. But I don't know what's going to be yet. So I'll probably look at a Frank Miller Daredevil just to balance off what we're going to be talking about here with Holy Terror. So that's as good a transition as any. For now, it's time for this month's feature, which is Frank Miller's Holy Terror. Now, up till now, Longbox Graveyard's podcast has been a monologue. It's been me sitting here in my garage, talking on a microphone, you people listening, which I, of course, appreciate. This month, I'm going to do my first interview. But rather than interview some old comics fart, and I know plenty of them, and we may do that eventually, But rather than interview comics farts, I thought I'd talk with my son, Miles O'Connor, who's with me here tonight. Miles is a thoughtful young man that I've been trying to introduce to comics with varying degrees of success. But one of the places where I've had some small success with Miles is with Frank Miller Books. He's a big fan of Sin City. So for Christmas, I got him a copy of Holy Terror. And Miles has read it. I've read it. We haven't really spoken about it before tonight's podcast. I thought we'd just have a conversation about Holy Terror and also, well, you'll see as we get into it. So let's start with introducing Miles, who's been sitting here patiently next to me while I've read off my news. So hello, Miles.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for talking with us today. So tell us a little bit about yourself. How old are you, Miles?
I'm 15 years old.
15, and you just started school, right?
That's right. First year of freshman.
You're a freshman in high school, right?
Yep.
And it's a new school for you.
Yep. New transition.
Yeah, so it's been a busy couple weeks for you while you're getting used to a new school. You know, what do you like to do?
I like to watch movies. I like to game, but mostly watch movies. I also love writing screenplays, and once I get started on a screenplay, it's hard for me to stop.
Probably film's your greatest passion.
For sure.
You think. And we bonded over a number of pictures. So tell me about some of your favorite films. What's your favorite picture of all time?
Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction. Okay. So Child Protective Services is inbound to the house right now because I let you watch Pulp Fiction. Right?
Yes.
How old were you when you saw Pulp Fiction for the first time?
I don't think it was that long ago, maybe 6 or 7 months.
Yeah, so I'm not a totally bad dad. I did hold you off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you like Pulp Fiction so much?
Screenplay writing and direction and use of music, all of everything in that movie I love.
What about the screenplay?
I mostly love the juxtaposition with the characters, how they can be, you know, these big bad killers, but they can talk about very normal things. It's easy for pretty much nobody or a very normal person can relate with these people.
And it's fair to say it's a fairly dialogue-driven picture.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
You seem to have developed an ear for dialogue. You like a number of Tarantino pictures.
Yeah, all of them.
All of them. Is there any that you haven't seen yet?
Just Death Proof.
Death Proof. Okay, well, maybe you don't have to see that one at all because it's not that good. But, I mean, it's worth bringing that stuff up because, you know, you're a thoughtful kid and you developed a critical eye both for watching and describing what you're seeing, and you're carrying this forward into your own screenplays. What kind of writing do you do?
Like you said, screenplays. I mostly like to write crime, so I take great influence from Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, and I like Danny Boyle a lot. What I typically like to write about is crime, and I've been trying to write about horror, or I should say thriller, because I don't usually have supernatural elements in my horror movies.
Mm-hmm. What are the great horror pictures you like? What do you like most?
I like Drag Me to Hell a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I like The Shining a lot. I like...
You mentioned Danny Boyle, so 28 Days Later.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, 28 Days Later. It's my favorite zombie movie.
It's worth mentioning because that's a movie that's... looks like a zombie movie, but it's really kind of about the end of the world.
Yeah.
Right? And as we've discussed, you and I before, zombie movies are about anything but zombies. The zombies just put pressure on the characters, mm-hmm. who then, through their actions, reveal themselves to be either, the saviors of the human race or their own worst enemies.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't focus too much on the zombies, it's pretty good.
Yeah, you kind of lose people when they go to the zombies.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an end-of-the-world story, and so is Holy Terror in its way.
Yeah.
But, you know, before we get to Holy Terror, maybe tell me a little bit about 9/11. So as we record this podcast earlier this week on Tuesday, I think was the, what is it now, 11 years since the September 11th attacks on the United States, on World Trade Center, on the Pentagon. So you've grown up in a world. You were 4 years old on the day of 9/11, and we can talk about that if you like a little bit.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You've grown up in a world where all you've known is 9/11.
Yeah, I don't see much of a difference because I didn't know the world before that.
Right, you have nothing to compare it to.
Nothing to compare it to.
When do you first recall becoming aware there was such a thing as 9/11?
I'm sure I was aware of it before then, but when I really figured it out was I think I was in fourth, fifth grade, and our teacher had a moment of silence, except I didn't know what we were having a moment of silence for. They never actually told us it was an attack.
Interesting.
They just said, let's have a moment of silence, and I had to, I think, ask you or Mom. I don't quite remember.
So there was no context about what they were observing?
No, the first time, no. As years and years go by, they actually explained us a little more.
Has it become part of your history curriculum? Do you recall it being formally addressed in class?
No. Actually, no. I remember finding out about it myself. You know, I've had to, you know, search YouTube for it. I've had to do reading on it myself. I don't think they actually really explain it in class.
What do you think that might be?
I don't know. I think they're just... Schools are very careful about other people's feelings and religion, and it's all these touchy subjects, so schools have to treat everybody the same in order to not offend anybody and, you know, get sued.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a shame. I think that by showing that we're still affected by it, you know, I think that's kind of a victory. You know, that, you know, we should still honor those that had to sacrifice their lives for this ridiculous attack. But it's just very upsetting that we're still so afraid of it that we can't teach our younger generation about it.
Well, that's kind of the purpose of a terrorist attack, is to terrorize.
Yeah.
Right? To rob us of our courage and our thought, make us feel unsafe in our beds. But, you know, I think one of the reasons that it isn't addressed in school, I'm interested to hear that it hasn't been formally addressed, at least not that you can recall. One of the reasons it isn't formally addressed is that we haven't had a lot of time. I mean, this is the whole world you've grown up in, but it's only been a decade since these attacks. You compare that to World War II, which is now 60 years in the past, and there's an opportunity to have some perspective and really understand what that event meant to world history. Whereas with 9/11, we're still in an evolving world where we don't have a lot of perspective. And also, of course, because it's within living memory and we know people who died in that attack, it's difficult to have any kind of objective look at this. It's all very personal to us, and it likely will be for generations. But, you know, it's worth understanding that there was a time when the way people feel about 9/11 is the way they felt about Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
We still, you know, when December 7th rolls around, I look at the calendar and think, geez, today's Pearl Harbor Day. And I think something about it, but I'm a student of history. I think most people probably don't think that. It just doesn't occur to them.
Sad.
I guess it is sad, but, you know, it's also an indication that people move on. And, you know, it wasn't the end of the world. And you know, World War II was a far more catastrophic global event than thus far this very terrible war on terror has been. Fewer lives were lost at Pearl Harbor than at the 9/11 attacks. But the war that followed was considerably more catastrophic.
Yeah.
Tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people dead. So... Do you remember anything about 9/11 itself, about the day of 9/11?
No, no details. I just know what happened.
So it's all just what you've picked up since then and the conversations we've had.
All I've been able to... I mean, I didn't know anything else was special. I know that there have been a few other... There was an attempted attack and another attack.
Mm-hmm.
But all I've really known about for a while was just the World Trade Center.
Well, here's maybe I'll score some points with the audience that are already frowning at me for letting my son watch... Quentin Tarantino and Martin Scorsese pictures. Is the reason you don't have any memory of that day, aside from being four, is I turned the televisions off. On the morning of 9/11, I got a phone call early in the morning from my sister-in-law, who was watching television on the East Coast, and she said, and she's in the military, and she said, listen, you need to get up and turn on your television. An airplane flew into the World Trade Center. I said, well, that's terrible. And she said, yes, and while the cameras were focused on the World Trade Center, another plane flew into the World Trade Center. And I remember instantly, as fuzzy as I was, instantly saying, that sounds like an attack. And she said, darn right it's an attack. Watch your television, find out what's going on. So we got up, we switched on the television set, started to see these terrible images, and you were still asleep. But it wasn't long before you got up and came into the room, and your mom and I just made a decision on the spot, you know what, we're not going to pour all these images into our four-year-old's head. It's just not going to happen. So we turned the television off, and you did what a four-year-old does that day. You played, you hung out, and ran around, and never napped, because you never napped. You're always a handful.
Yeah.
And, you know, I snuck a glance every now and then and listened to the radio, but I got kind of a fractured account of what happened that day. But you know what? It actually was a good thing, because I didn't sit there and get traumatized by these repeated images again and again, which happened to our whole country for the people that were glued to that coverage. And I also knew, with my perspective of history, that it was going to be a long time before we really understood what was happening. And maybe a couple days worth of perspective wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for getting that information. So that's why you don't remember the day. I mean, you might have. You might still have forgotten it, but I think subconsciously, if you were just a kid and you're seeing buildings burning, and especially if you saw your mom and dad being affected by it, that would just serve to undermine and make you insecure. In a way, that would be letting the terrorists win.
Yeah.
So that's why we didn't let you see it.
Thanks.
Well, yeah, you're welcome, right? But it's, you know, it's the world you live in now, and it's the world you've grown up in. Like you said, that to you, there is no normal.
Yeah, I look at a picture of New York City, and, you know, all the adults can't imagine it without the World Trade Center. And yeah. I don't see any difference. I look at New York, and it looks completely normal to me.
It was never there. Now, we live in California, but we did take a trip to New York as a family, and we did go to Ground Zero. Do you remember doing that?
No.
You have no memory of that?
No memory of New York.
Because we walked up to Ground Zero, which was still very raw at that time. It was only, I don't know, 2 years after the attack or something. And it was just a big hole in the ground, like the socket of a tooth. And all the facing buildings and that hole in the ground had been blown out. And it was pretty sober.
Did you tell me what had happened?
I don't know if we discussed it or not. I must have, because I can't imagine that we would have gone there and that you'd seen this thing and I wouldn't tell you about it. I mean, at that time, they'd cleared the rubble, of course. It just looked like a big construction site, maybe. Mm-hmm. So maybe it needed a little bit of context, but you don't remember that either, right?
No.
No, that's all right. So because it's a comic book podcast, let's get around to talking about Holy Terror.
All right.
So I gave you this graphic novel for Christmas, right?
Yeah.
Gee, what a cheery Christmas present.
Holy Terror.
Should give you a handgun, a box of cigs, too. That would be... so you've read Holy Terror.
Yeah.
Right? So, tell me about it. First of all, what did you think of it? Did you like it? Did you dislike it?
I did like it.
You did like it?
I did.
Okay. So, what did you like about Holy Terror?
Wow. I know. I like the way it was illustrated. And in some moments, I did like the way it was illustrated. And I remember there were some pages that felt very scribbled and very raw.
Mm-hmm.
There was some panels where it was hard to see what was going on. I had to stare at it for a while. But I feel like it added to a kind of miserable experience. Like it should have been, you know. It's a miserable experience to read it, but I think it's engaging, and it's Frank Miller.
Mm-hmm. And you're a fan of Frank Miller.
Yeah.
So a little bit of background here is I've tried a number of times over the years to get you engaged with comic books, and you prefer video games and film.
Yeah.
Now you're not totally, you don't hate comics, but they're not your first choice, right? So which comics have connected with you in the past?
Ooh, Sin City. Scott Pilgrim, I like Judge Dredd. The ones you've given me over it, I like those.
Walking Dead too.
Walking Dead, very much so.
Right.
Yeah, that's been deep. It's deeply affecting me.
And for the most part, those are all generally more adult comics. Dredd maybe less than the others, but they're they're black and white books for the most part, and they deal with adult themes, and they got a lot of violence and. So what'd you like about Sin City? Because I think most of the listeners would agree that Sin City is considered a masterpiece of comics, whereas they'd have the opposite opinion of Holy Terror. What do you think of Sin City? I assume you like Sin City better than Holy Terror, I assume?
Oh, yeah. I do like Sin City better than Holy Terror. And I see similarities in the way it's drawn. The look of Empire City is very similar to Sin City. And what I like that Frank Miller does in Sin City is he uses images that take up the whole panel. And you just flip through 3 or 4 pages straight, and it'll just be one image with no captions or dialogue, and I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some of that in Holy Terror as well, especially in Holy Terror. There were, 3 or 4 pages in a row that didn't have more than a grunt or more than a word spoken.
Maybe a cinematic approach in these storytelling is kind of what you're describing. So the older comics, Silver Age or the Bronze Age Marvels that I've handed you are really pretty dense. Right, densely told stories, lots of boxes, lots of word balloons, lots of captions. Whereas these Miller stories, they have a little more room to breathe.
Yeah.
All right, so you liked Sin City. Now, Holy Terror, so you recognize it as being the same guy.
Yeah.
You recognize it as the same author. And we discussed a little bit before you read it what it was about, the origins of Holy Terror, beginning as a project called Holy Terror Batman! It was supposed to be a story, a revenge story of Batman. In fact, I got a quote here. When it was in development, Frank Miller described it as propaganda and cited the famous cover of Captain America #1 with Cap planting a punch on Hitler's jaw, right? There's a quote from him. He said, Frank Miller said, "I've always adored superheroes. With holy terror, I seek to return to the traditions of the 1940s, back when Nazism was identified as an existential enemy, just as the Islamo-fascists have shown themselves to be in my time. Superheroes fight bad guys. These are very bad guys." And then he embraced the term propaganda, saying, "Propaganda has gotten a bad name. Some things called propaganda only when the reader disagrees with it. If they agree, it's called relevant. An artist expressing a point of view, whatever the medium, whatever the story's intent, that's propaganda and it's relevant." So we did discuss a little bit before you read Holy Terror that A, was a controversial piece, and B, that he did intend it as a piece of propaganda. What do you think propaganda is?
Well, like, this is definitely propaganda, but what I think propaganda is I really have no comment on that. I just know I hear propaganda and I think of it, I don't really think of it as a negative thing.
Mm-hmm. When you read Holy Terror, did you think that it was telling you a true story or a fantasy story?
I think it was so surreal, it's kind of hard to decide. I think it's fantasy in a way. Mm-hmm. It felt a little goofy at times. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're completely serious, and it was emotional at times, but it was also very, very goofy.
Clearly it leverages people's beliefs and feelings about 9/11. It doesn't explain what 9/11 is. If you were coming to this with no experience at that event, you wouldn't know what's going on, right?
No, it took me a while to find out that, I think I read it twice, and the first time I didn't pick up on the screws and razor blades, and I think I figured out that it was shrapnel from the attack,
mm-hmm.
and that's a symbol. I had no idea what that was or what that what falling screws and razor blades was until I read it a second time.
Mm-hmm. And it's unclear. I think it might be construed that these are pieces of debris from an explosion or an attack on a building, but I think what Miller's showing us here is this is like what they call an IED, an improvised explosive device, which is used by the insurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they put together these basically nail bombs and they string them by the side of the road, and kids go through in their Humvees and the bombs go off and they get this cheap shrapnel blown into their bodies, which is a terrible thing. Certainly none of those devices were used on 9/11 itself.
No.
9/11 was an attack conducted by flying airliners into buildings. There's no razor bombs flying all over the place. There weren't any suicide bombers on 9/11. There have been suicide bombers later, but I think it's worth noting the suicide bombers have been confined to the Middle East, to Iraq, to attacks in Israel. Haven't had any suicide bomber attacks here in the United States. But you wouldn't tell that, couldn't tell that by reading Holy Terror. It seems a pretty scary world in Holy Terror, I think.
Yeah.
So to go back and answer my own question, propaganda is news that's intended to manipulate rather than to inform. So we have a tradition in the United States that the news should be impartial, that the news should be objective, that the news should be devoid of opinion, at least overt opinion, as much as possible. Put the facts in front of people, stick to the facts. Now, this is certainly something that our news media has a hard time with, has had an increasingly hard time with. It's not always, it's actually kind of an older tradition in news. News began as political party broadsheets that were distributed to people. It had a very distinct point of view. But when news moved to public airwaves, television and radio, there was at least lip service given to the idea that things would be balanced and true. Propaganda as news generally comes from the state that espouses a particular point of view as if it were fact. So,
1984, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. So, 1984 is a rigidly controlled information state where people are told this is truth, and there's no doubting it.
Yeah.
Propaganda has been used in all our wars. I think, because Mr. Miller talked about Nazism, the preeminent example of propaganda in the 20th century is probably the Third Reich. Leni Riefenstahl doing movies like Triumph of the Will with tens of thousands of party adherents marching through the night with their flaming torches and their swastika brands, and Hitler standing up there at Nuremberg reviewing them all. I mean, these are powerful images that go on the screen that tell you that this is a united nation that is going to conquer the world. whereas the reality on the ground was, you know, was different. There wasn't that. There was unity in Germany, but there were dissenters too. Not everybody was on board, and a portion of their population was being exterminated at the same time. You didn't see that in the films. So it's interesting that Miller says that he intends Holy Terror to be propaganda, but doesn't really seem to understand what propaganda is. He says something's called propaganda only when the reader disagrees with it. And if they agree, it's called relevant. I think he's missed the point there.
Yeah.
I mean, he's saying that any facts that he offers that you disagree with become propaganda? I'm not sure.
Hmm.
It's a little kind of a slippery slope. So I think he kind of wants to have his cake and eat it too here, saying, well, this is like Captain America punching Hitler or Batman punching Hitler. But it really isn't, right? Because he seems like he's taking this thing pretty seriously.
Yeah, it's... Are you mostly saying by, like, how goofy those comics are? And it's not really being taken that seriously?
Yes. Well, that's a good point. So when Captain America number one came out in 1940 or 1941, when Simon and Kirby did it, it was a gigantically successful comic book. Sold 1 million copies. It was actually published before the United States was at war with Hitler, so it was a provocative image. And, you know, Simon and Kirby got death threats and all the other stuff because the United States at that time didn't want to, there was a large number of people in the country that didn't want to go to war. There were German Americans here. The scope of Hitler's villainy was not fully understood. The public was divided over whether or not we should be at war with Germany. It was a controversial thing. Before long, the bombs fell on Pearl Harbor and we were in the war for better or worse. But at that time, it was a fairly provocative image. But Captain America comics, you know, they were sold as an all-ages title, and they sold 1 million copies, so it wasn't just kids buying them. But comics were not intended for adults, necessarily. I guess they were general audience. Anybody who might pick up a newspaper might read a comic. But this thing here, yeah, Holy Terror, so this is a $20 hardback, right? It's not something that a kid's going to get for a nickel and fold it up and carry it around his back pocket and ride his bike to the treehouse and trade it with his friends, right?
No.
It's pretty obviously intended for an older audience.
Yeah, a lot of comics are nowadays, or graphic novels.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other show, right? So you said you thought it was kind of cartoonish or kind of goofy. What were the words? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Holy Terror? Yeah, I thought that there were some very silly and goofy moments in it, but it was also very serious at times.
Mm-hmm. So and tone's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, and that didn't really bother me. I wasn't bothered by it because I've always found Frank Miller's stuff super serious and kind of goofy too, which is, I don't think is a bad thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sin City has a fair balance of some really goofy stuff that happens and some really serious stuff that happens. And I've been perfectly fine with it.
So what was goofy?
Well, I think that, you know, our the hero, the Fixer, who's obviously Batman, right? And Cat Burglar, which is Catwoman, are... I thought the romance was a little goofy between them. And it was trying to be adult when it was kind of goofy.
Yeah.
You know, there's all that. They're punching each other, then they're kissing each other in the rain. I thought that's like, ooh, that's Frank Miller.
Now, you know a little bit about Batman, right? I don't think you've read any Batman comics, right?
No.
Notably, you know, as much as you like Frank Miller, you've never read Dark Knight, which was his reinvention of Batman, right?
I read Batman and Robin.
Oh, All-Star Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
Okay, that's another equally reviled book. Now I'm really going to get in trouble because, it's a tangent, but you kind of like that, right?
I did, yeah. I like the take on the character.
And what is it about the character you liked in All-Star Batman and Robin?
Maybe it's just because it was so original.
How was it original?
Well, I mean, I've always figured it'd be kind of interesting to see a take on Batman where he is obviously insane or has mental issues.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I always thought, you know, a guy that dresses up as a bat and, you know, has no superpowers is a little mental.
Definitely.
In a superhero world, he's not mental. Because it's obviously normal for one superhero to run around while the cops chase him.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that did get me a little confused was in this version of Batman, it also had, you know, Wonder Woman, Plastic Man, and, you know, the group, which also had superpowers.
Yeah.
You know, it had Superman and Green Lantern, and... Those guys have superpowers, and Batman doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's able to fit in with these characters in other books where he doesn't have powers, but he's able to fit in with these superheroes. And to see him as a threat to all the characters that normally back him up is actually kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. It was a different take. It was a different world. And Frank Miller has said that All-Star Batman and Robin is intended to reside in the same comic world as Dark Knight.
Okay.
So what you're seeing there is the guy that's going to turn into the very kind of bitter and the bitter, brawling Dark Knight character in a comic that you haven't read yet. But you've been influenced by this because you've seen all the movies, right? Right where we're sitting, I can look up here and see the three posters in the Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy. Batman Begins, Dark Knight Rises, which we saw just recently. So you've seen plenty of Frank Miller-style Batman, even if you didn't know it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Nolan pictures aren't purely based on Frank Miller, but they're heavily influenced by Frank Miller. So that was a long tangent. The reason I mentioned it is this idea about the Fixer and Catwoman. What's her name in the book? Do you even remember?
Cat Burglar.
Cat Burglar? Well, that's a stretch. So this relationship between the Fixer and Cat Burglar is something that bleeds over from the Batman books, where Batman and Catwoman have had this kind of, you know, fatal attraction for each other down through the years. It's, you know, sometimes a consummated romance, and other times it's simmering beneath the surface. So, as you know, Holy Terror began its life as a Batman book.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of shorthand there that any Batman fan would recognize immediately what's going on with these characters, and their coming together like that wouldn't alarm them or surprise them. But in the context of this book, did it make sense to you?
No, because it's not Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if it was Batman and Catwoman, I'd understand, because I've been raised to know those two are together.
Yeah.
And I could figure out it was Batman after about halfway through, because I didn't think you told me it was a Batman book.
Right.
Until I was about halfway through it. And then it made sense, but I was a little confused about what was going on.
I gotta say, I'm glad that you acknowledge I've raised you to know that Batman and Catwoman are a couple. I'm glad I'm giving you some wisdom in life. It's not any kind of wisdom that's going to help you. And in fact, never mention that to a girl. Ever.
Okay.
Okay, that's poison. That's as bad as saying, "Let me tell you about my character."
Oh.
You know, let me tell you about my cleric in our D&D game. Don't do that. I mean, be yourself, but don't be that much yourself. Okay? I like you to have a girlfriend. All right. So, so Holy Terror. Okay, so you thought, you liked the Frank Millerisms of it. You recognized who the characters were.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the controversial side of the story, okay? And I know you haven't gone online and read any of the reviews. You know, you've got more important things to do. God bless you. But I should tell you that critical reaction to this book, to Holy Terror, has been almost universally negative. Not just from comic book fans and reviewers, but also just from the general press that looked at it and said a number of things that, you know, the book seems kind of prejudicial, that the book is jingoistic, meaning that it's repeating lies about people or casting people as villains that shouldn't be vilified that way. I mean, did you have a sense? Tell me the story of Holy Terror. I mean, what did you expect going in, first of all, and then what did you get?
I expected a Batman style battle with Al Qaeda, basically.
Right.
And that's kind of what I got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing more, nothing less. And I mean, I didn't learn anything special.
Right.
You know, I went through it and ended on the same note it started on, and maybe he meant it to be that way. And mm-hmm. once again, I don't think that's a negative thing. But there was nothing incredibly special about the comic book that makes it any more substantial than punching Hitler in the face or anything else.
It doesn't add up to the previous Frank Miller books, though.
Oh, no, definitely not.
Right, it's just not as entertaining.
No.
Do you think it was fair to people?
Are you saying just to, like, the Middle East?
Yeah.
Well, of course not, but this is, you know, this is the time right now, and it's going to seem relevant to us maybe in, you know, a couple years. It won't anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. America goes through times where we had war with Vietnam, and now we don't think of that anymore, right?
Sure.
You know, so there's going to be, you know, right now, yeah, it's definitely unfair. You know, there's really stupid low blows to Muslims in the Middle East in this book, and
mm-hmm.
Right now it seems relevant because everyone's super angry. Right, and, you know, of course, I'm pretty angry about it.
Sure.
So I'm okay with it, and I'm not offended by it, but maybe in the future, you know, maybe give it another 30 or 40 years, and it's, you know, been a while in the past now, or, you know, and eventually, and we're not going to really, I think maybe we'll find it a little more offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Since right now we're so angry about it, we're letting it go.
It's very raw,
yeah.
Right? It's very current. So what Miller would have said, paraphrasing him, is that, you know, during World War II, there were movie serials where, you know, Batman, specifically Batman, was fighting the enemies that we were fighting at that time, and using pejorative terms for Japanese people and for German people that people just ate up with a spoon watching these movies in the theaters. And that was an actual shooting war where people had loved ones overseas, and it was perfectly fine. We look back on it now and we feel a little embarrassed by it, but we dismiss it as being a casualty of the age. Here we are, some of us, looking back at Mr. Miller's work right now and being a little embarrassed by it, thinking that it kind of lacks a certain maturity or subtlety or nuance in the way it's trying to portray a very complicated subject.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you said that it's kind of a silly story, right? It's got these characters bounding about on rooftops and doing all this superhero stuff. I mean, let's take a look at Holy Terror as if it were a mathematical equation. I know math is your favorite subject, right?
No.
Yeah. But let's do it anyway. So one of the things you learn about math is that math is, you know, you can plug variables in and out. You can take a 7, turn it into a 5, and it changes the equation, right? So if this story is an equation that's designed to provoke a reaction, let's change some variables around a little bit. If we took out Al-Qaeda entirely out of this story, and it was the Fixer and Cat Burglar against the ruthless hordes of Hydra.
Okay.
You know, an apolitical, not the Hydra that you've seen in the Captain America movie, which is, you know, a Nazi front or something. Okay, a group you haven't heard of. The machinations of AIM, Advanced Idea Mechanics. You've never heard of them, right?
No.
Okay, I failed as a father, but you've never heard of Advanced Idea Mechanics. Okay, so AIM is a bunch of guys in yellow beekeeper outfits that employ super science to try, just because it's cool, and also parenthetically to try to destroy the world. And they make super intelligent cyborg creatures to lord us. Well, I'm getting off track here. I'm getting too excited. All right, but let's say it's AIM that set off a bomb in Empire City. And the Fixer and Catwoman, or Catgirl, whatever she is.
Cat Burglar,
thank you. They've got to go deal with it. Would the story still work?
I don't know. It might, I guess. I didn't feel like Al-Qaeda in the story was really that substantial. I mean, it was offensive, and, you know, I mean, I wasn't offended by it. I'm sure people are, but, you know, it's kind of offensive and goofy, and it's fun, but also kind of pathetic, and
there was nothing about the bad guys that really made them bad guys,
well,
aside from being told they're bad guys?
Yeah, it's kind of like America hates them. You know, you're told to hate them because you live in America,
mm-hmm.
So if you automatically hear Middle East, you have to think of terror. That's all you got to think of.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what we're being taught in this century.
It's kind of an easy target,
yeah.
Right? Notwithstanding that there is a war on terror going on, it's very serious business. But if I'm doing a comic book and I say you're fighting AIM, I have to try to they have to shoot somebody's dog, right? I gotta do something so that you're gonna think AIM is, you know, these are nasty guys and they deserve to be stopped.
It's not like Nazis. You just gotta say they're Nazis, or you know, you just gotta say, oh, it's Taliban, or so on.
So in his storytelling, then, Frank Miller is kind of, you know, he's using the shorthand of, we all know who these enemies are and have to describe why they're bad. They're automatically bad. Let's go get them.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of a shortcut. And that is the root of why a lot of people were offended by the book.
Hmm.
So let's, you know, we'll get to that in a second. So let's flip out that variable. Let's look at another variable. If instead of Al-Qaeda being the villains, the bad guys were, you just mentioned a minute ago, were the Nazis, right?
Okay.
We roll this thing back, it's 1940, and a bomb goes off, and it's the Red Skull and a bunch of Sieg Heiling goons, right?
Okay.
They're trying to take over Manhattan. And would it work then? Would the story work then?
It might. I mean, I wasn't alive during World War II. You know, you weren't alive during World War II.
No, it just seems like it.
Yeah, you know, as much as I've been taught about the Nazis, you know, they're terrible people, but Nazis the kind of Nazis you see in comic books, and, you know, when I think of Nazi now in comic books, I think of the Nazis from, like, Inglourious Basterds or something.
Mm-hmm. Or Indiana Jones.
Or Indiana Jones.
Nazis, I hate those guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't really see them as, you know, these terrible people, which they were, but since I wasn't raised in that time, and it's, you know, been a while, we've had, oh, you know, a war in front of that now.
Right.
Too.
But you've seen, you know, we watched Saving Private Ryan together.
Yeah.
You've also seen Downfall, which is, you know, a different look at what the Nazis were about.
But since it's less relevant to my timeline, maybe I'm not as offended by it or, you know, deeply affected by it.
So it sounds to me almost like Nazi villains are as goofy as AIM would be.
Yeah, they're right? Getting there.
They're almost as less relevant. Well,
they look kind of goofy, too.
Okay. Well, in Holy Terror, the enemies are all... they all appear to be, at least, people of color from the Middle East.
Yeah.
It's fair to say, perhaps, the enemies are all Muslim. So let's do one more sniff test here. Let's do one more equation and see if this would give you a different opinion. If you read Holy Terror and it was the same story, but the bad guys, instead of being Al-Qaeda, the bad guys were all Jews and drawn the way they were in World War II propaganda. So they're hunchbacked and hook-nosed and hairy and the dirty teeth and vulpine eyes and they're greedy and they're drooling and they're very threatening. You've seen, I think, some of those cartoons.
Yeah, I went to the Museum of Tolerance.
That's right, you're at the Museum of Tolerance. So if all the enemies were drawn that way, and they were all referred to as Israelites or Jews, then how would you feel about the book?
I'd be offended by it.
Yeah,
even if I'm not Jewish myself, I'd be offended by it. It would be pretty ridiculous.
Because you can look at that.
Yeah.
You can look at that depiction and understand that it's unfair and it's a hot button, right?
Yeah.
But you know what it is?
What?
It's propaganda.
Yeah.
Right? Because those images come to us from the Nazis and actually from centuries before, from endemic anti-Semitism that's been a part of European history going back centuries. This image of, you know, the Jew as the moneylender, as the predatory creature. Likewise, if you read Holy Terror and the enemies were all black people, mm-hmm. that were drawn as caricatures of black people with big white rolling eyes and large lips, right? Or even if they were drawn as like, you know, contemporary urban blacks as being, you know, ghetto guys, you know, with big chains or whatever, that might make you a little uncomfortable
as well.
Yeah,
I'd be uncomfortable too. Yeah.
So that's the interesting thing is I didn't really, until I started thinking about Holy Terror, I didn't think about it in those terms. When I read it, I was like, you know, I just kind of read it. I was prepared to hate it. I didn't really hate it. I didn't think it was that great. I was a little disappointed in it because it just, I didn't think it was that coherent as a story. But when I read it, I just thought, well, yeah, it's one-sided, but it's a small story. I kind of expected that the character was going to go on this global mission of revenge. He was going to go all over the place and win the war on terror by himself. He really was going to go punch Hitler. He was going to go into some cave and drag Osama out by the beard and beat him to within an inch of his life. But
that'd be cool.
That isn't what happened. Instead, it was this very kind of small story set among just a few characters in a brief period of time. And I thought because the scope of the story was so small, criticism against it being so one-sided and not showing any good Muslims, and after all, we're talking about a world religion of a billion people with a very small fraction that have been radicalized that we're, you know, that our tribe is at war with right now. Most of these people are peaceful and totally appalled at what's being done in the name of their religion.
Yeah.
But I looked at it and thought, well, it's forgivable because it's just such a small story. Because it's not trying to show what the Muslim world is like. It's these happen to be Muslim villains, and it's an attack on New York, and this is how our hero responds. But when I took a step back and thought of it in terms of, okay, let's do that swap. Let's do that kind of Hitler test. Let's put Jewish characters as a villain. Let's put black characters as a villain. Would I at that point be uncomfortable? And I realized, yeah, I really would be. And that's where a lot of the criticism of this book, I think, centers.
It's because people aren't offended by it?
Because people are afraid that it offers such a black and white and maybe ultimately unfair viewpoint on something that's much more complex. Maybe something that is still a little too raw. Maybe something that shouldn't yet be addressed in such a kind of a flippant fashion. And Miller seems to want to have it both ways. When the book is kind of silly, well, it's propaganda and it's goofy, but when the book is serious, it's a message book. Because it's talking about the, you know, the necessary man. Like in the book, several times, our hero, the Fixer, as I recall, he kind of likes it when the war starts. Doesn't he say something along the lines of, you know, now I'm complete.
Yeah.
Right? He lives only for war. So there's some potentially interesting stuff in there, but it's kind of lost in this controversy.
Yeah. maybe we're just not ready for it yet.
Well, maybe not.
You know, we can, when we talk about the Nazis, we can go one side on them. It's black and white with the Nazis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right now. And it wasn't, right? And back then, was it that way? Or?
No. But Miller would say during the war, just while the war was going on, just 1 or 2 years after the war began, that we were doing these, you know, real propagandistic kind of depictions of them.
We're fighting a very different enemy right now than the Nazis.
That's
and,
true.
And, you know, it's easy to say black and white for Nazis, even during the war. But maybe right now we're in a war where, you know, even we feel offended by it to call our enemies that. Mm-hmm. You know, just by singling out an entire religion and taking a small percentage of that and, you know, dressing them up like this on the cover, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we are offended about that.
Maybe we did it once, but that's doesn't mean we should do it again.
Yeah.
Maybe we can write ourselves a check and say, well, in the 1940s, we didn't know better. Maybe we should have known better, but
mm-hmm.
now we definitely should know better.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've studied a little bit of history. I'm obviously a big fan of history, and we talk about it whenever we can. And Second World War was a very complex subject. It was far more than just fighting Nazi Germany, but
yeah.
that's our subject. We'll stick with it. But, you know, Nazi Germany was led by some terrible men, evil men, that led their nation and the world into ruin. But that nation was also composed of young men that wanted to fight for their country, women and mothers and wives that stayed behind, children that grew up in the midst of this chaos. And, you know, we drop bombs on them just like they drop bombs on us. The Nazis were evil. They had to go. The German people suffered tremendously, as did the people that they inflicted their violence upon. We know now it's a more complex situation than the movies of the day would have us believe.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that probably this war on terror is a more complex situation than the movies of the day would have us believe.
Yeah, because it's not just black and white in this war. It's a very, you know, it feels like it's a much smaller war, in my opinion, than something like World War II, where, you know, I mean, it could escalate and get much bigger than it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't find it. I mean, when I look at movies like Longest Day and movie like black and white war movies like that,
mm-hmm.
they all end on a very wonderful note. You know, they're always playing that music, and you know, everyone's. You know, I mean, there's a lot of deaths, but you know, the Americans won the war, and that's mm-hmm. grand. You know, but you know, we didn't win the war in Vietnam, so we don't see as many movies about that. And
or if we do, they have a different tone.
Oh yeah,
they look at
like,
something else.
It's
right?
not really about the victory; it's about the destruction of the people that go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And
but the effect of war. War is the enemy in a Vietnam picture.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas in these World War II films, the ones made during the war certainly are very kind of rah-rah. The ones made after are generally victory laps, you know, made by veterans for veterans. It doesn't mean that they turn away from the realities of war. Some of those films can be quite affecting, depending upon the person that was making. You look at
Private Ryan.
Well, Private Ryan, of course, was made many years later, but you look at like a Sam Fuller picture or something,
mm-hmm.
You know, who was a veteran. And it experienced a pretty terrible reality over there. Yeah, so it's like we rushed off to war once in the middle of a media age. And that really was what was different about World War II. There's always been propaganda in war, but World War II, that information could travel really fast over radio and over newsreels. Who was it? I think it was Mark Twain said that a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. We're all interested in hearing the sensational story. We'll rush to judgment. It's easy for us to fill in the blanks and say, yeah, the Nazis are evil people, and they were. But we can watch these movies and just not think too deeply about what's happening because the information was coming at us so fast. And that was different from times in the past. Now information moves even faster, but we have an example of history where we know any number of times that these conflicts have turned out to be so much more complex than we thought they were. Maybe we shouldn't rush to judgment about what this war is actually about.
So we are... Maybe it's just childish, you know, is what we're thinking.
It seems like there's some childishness here.
Yeah.
Which is painful, right? Because I love Frank Miller.
Yeah, I think he's great.
You know, I think Miller, putting on my long box graveyard hat here, I think Miller is one of the all-time greats in this field. This guy has it all, or at least had it all. He could write, he could create, he could plot, he could do dialogue, and he could draw like a son of a gun. He's in a rare class of Will Eisner, Hal Foster, just a few that really can do it all. And to see A, his choice of subject, and B, kind of how it executed was a little disappointing to me.
Yeah. It did feel like the story moved at a as a straight line. You know, it escalated as the attack began and didn't go any further. Mm-hmm. It just stayed at a... I feel like it began and ended on the same note it started on, almost.
No arc.
Yeah, no arc that made it exciting. And most of Frank Miller stuff, like with Sin City, there's always that middle part that makes it so good. And mm-hmm. it always ends with a tremendous climax, and it's always worth reading.
No real character transformation in Holy Terror.
No, it's just a symbol beating up other stereotypes.
Right. But at the same time, there's some real hot-button things in here that people were offended by. For instance, the evil, you know, the cell of Al-Qaeda is located beneath a mosque, right? Beneath mm-hmm. a Muslim church. And even Miller seems to know he's going over the line here a little bit, because I think he has Catgirl say, "You're talking about bringing in an orbital laser strike on a mosque?" And he goes, "Well, I'm thinking about it," right? Oh. But he knows he's kind of crossing the line there, right? But there was a time in this country after the wake of the attacks where we were concerned about mosques perhaps sheltering terror cells behind the constitutional right of, you know, right to assembly and freedom of religion. There was this feeling that, geez, maybe these people are in our midst and these terror cells are going to emerge and wreak havoc upon our country. But in the 11 years since 9/11, mosques have not, you know, proven to be not the case. Now, to my knowledge, I don't have any encyclopedic knowledge. Maybe somebody can dig up a reference somewhere of a terror cell in a mosque that was broken up, but they certainly haven't proven to be these urban fortresses, you know, swarming with Al-Qaeda rats in the sewer like they show us. And
just fear talking out of Frank Miller.
I think it is, and it also, but again, it's pushing that button.
Yeah.
Something that people are afraid of. And then, of course, there's the young woman, the suicide bomber, that appears in the book.
At the club.
Yeah. What did you think about her?
I remember that line where, you know, she drinks the alcohol.
Right.
For the first time, and she says, "This is my first drink." Mm-hmm. And goes into the club. And that was actually my first clue that she was actually a terrorist bomber.
Mm-hmm. That she was going to be a suicide bomber. And again, we haven't had suicide bomb attacks here.
Yeah,
in the
there's been references to suicide bombings in here.
Right.
A lot. And yeah.
When. So the September. No, I you got this just this year, right? I gave it to you for Christmas this year. When do you think Frank Miller wrote this and drew it?
I'm wondering if this is a completion or not. I guess I mean it's pretty angry for it to be in 2011 or 2010. I think it's pretty angry. Mm-hmm. And it's something you would write out a complete rage in, you know, a few months after 9/11. So I'd really guess like around that time, around the 9/11 attacks.
Right, immediately in the wake of the attacks.
Yeah, that's when I think he wrote it.
And had it been written in that time, maybe we'd understand it as an artifact of that age.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. So I guess it hadn't been written in that time.
No, it was just published within the last year or so. Now, it was a long gestating project. It took him a long time to finish it, and it has this strange publication history where it was going to start off as a Batman book and change mm-hmm. and this and that, but I believe it was announced 2005, 2006, so a good 4 or 5
it's
years.
It's been a while since the attack, so we've had some time to cool down a little bit.
Yeah.
And I guess he never cooled down.
I don't think he's cooled down at all.
That explains it.
Now, he's an interesting character, Frank Miller. I think his work is cathartic for him. I think he puts a lot of his rage into his work. He may claim that he doesn't. Certainly in interviews I've seen, he gives kind of an arch impression of being a gadfly that maybe isn't taking this all as seriously, but it doesn't seem to be the case. I finished reading a book which I'm reviewing at Longbox Graveyard in October, called Marvel Comics: The Untold Story, written by Sean Howe. And in that, Mr. Howe talks about how Frank Miller took over Daredevil, and this was, you haven't read his Daredevil, but it's real good. Daredevil was a comic that was dying at Marvel, and they gave Frank a chance to do it, and he revolutionized the character and revolutionized comics in a lot of ways. And when he took over that book, his original intent was to make Daredevil like he'd always been in the past, which was this kind of happy-go-lucky, swashbuckling, light, sort of Spider-Man-style character. But Howe tells a story, which I assume is true, that after getting the assignment to do Daredevil, Frank Miller, who was a kid from Vermont, was in New York, was mugged. That he was stopped on the street, some guy put a knife to his throat, took his wallet, and that this scared Frank and filled him with a rage against feeling so powerless, against being victimized by the city, and his approach to Daredevil changed. It became an urban crime story. It became a masterpiece of comics, but also became an outlet for all this kind of darkness that's in the world. That shows to me, and my, you know, here I am analyzing this guy on a podcast from thousands of miles away. I got no clue. But trying to connect the dots, I see him as somebody that can really absorb a lot of angst and put it into his work. And if he was so influenced by a mugging to create this dark, noirish, very kind of, you know, it's a real ordeal to read those Daredevil stories. Well, something as extreme as 9/11 might push him right over the edge.
Yeah. You saw his anger let out in Batman and Robin, right?
Yeah. Well, in Batman and Robin, he's kind of the cranky old man voice, I thought. The get off my lawn voice. And since you cue it up, let's talk about that real quick.
All right.
In November 2011, Frank made headlines again, not the best kind of headlines, with a statement on his blog where he lashed out against the Occupy movement. What do you know about the Occupy movement?
Yeah, it's people got fed up with the banks of Wall Street and, you know, laid down in the streets and protested and, you know, were there for good long days in the cold.
In effect, yeah, I think that's a simplification, but it's as good a summary as any. I mean, it's a new movement. It's not terribly well understood. Something about it really offends Frank. He did write on his blog. He said, this is quoting Mr. Miller. He says, "Everybody's been too damn polite about this nonsense. The Occupy movement, whether displaying itself on Wall Street or in the streets of Oakland, which has with unspeakable cowardice embraced it, is anything but an exercise of our blessed First Amendment. Occupy is nothing but a pack of louts, thieves, and rapists, an unruly mob fed by Woodstock-era nostalgia and putrid false righteousness. These clowns can do nothing but harm America." He goes on to say, "This is no popular uprising. This is garbage. And goodness knows they're spewing their garbage, both politically and physically, every way they can find. Wake up, pond scum. America is at war against a ruthless enemy. Maybe between bouts of self-pity and all the other tasty tidbits of narcissism you've been serving up in your sheltered, comfy little worlds, you've heard terms like Al-Qaeda and Islamicism. And this enemy of mine, not of yours apparently, must be getting a dark chuckle, if not an outright horse laugh, out of your vain, childish, self-destructive spectacle. In the name of decency, go home to your parents, you losers. Go back to your mama's basements and play with your Lords of Warcraft, or better yet, enlist for the real thing. Maybe our military could whip some of you into shape."
That's pretty grim.
Yeah, but does that sound like the Fixer?
Yes.
Does that sound a little bit like Batman and All-Star, Batman and Robin? I mean, this is a man that's not really patient with a nuanced point of view about anything other than a black and white view of something.
Uh-huh.
It's also very firm in that belief. I mean, he was ridiculed for that, but he left that blog post up. I mean, he's owning it. He's walking the walk. This thing was up in November. I just pulled that quote down yesterday. So it's not like he's retracted his comments at all.
I think what he's also saying is that we've got to, I mean, from his quote, he says, you know, we have a real enemy to fight right now. Why are we fighting ourselves? You think that's the truth?
I think that's a journal.
It's not grim in it, but he's saying, you know, look what's going on in the Middle East, and they're laughing at our really pathetic attempt to change things.
Mm-hmm.
He does seem like he's pretty cranky in that, mm-hmm. yelling about liberals and stuff. I just can imagine him being.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know which side he's supporting there. So it's an interesting insight, Miles, because you say that he looks at these people and saying that they're fighting the wrong people. They should be fighting Al-Qaeda. But who they're protesting against is the banks that wrecked our economy.
Yeah.
Right? They're protesting that they have a future that has no future, that their college degrees are worthless, that their opportunity to enjoy the fruits of our society have been limited by the mismanagement of the last several years that have led us into a pretty deep economic depression, which not coincidentally owes something to those Twin Towers coming down that, mm-hmm. you know, was one of the dominoes that ended up wrecking our world economy, right? But it's interesting because he's just telling people, go home, you're fighting the wrong people, but doesn't say who it is that they're fighting.
No.
I guess just the establishment?
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, is the United States the banks? Or is the United States something else?
It doesn't really make it that clear. I think he's just cranky.
Yeah, maybe so. And, you know, they say the first casualty of war is the truth. And we're too close to this thing, really, to understand what the truth is. I'll tell you the truth as I see it. You know, the truth is that our country was attacked. The truth is Our tribe is at war. The truth is that the United States is opposed culturally and politically by a force in this world that does not hold our values dear and would like to see us destroyed or humbled. But I also think that it is an American tendency to paint with a very broad brush these movements. You know, what we learned from World War II, is World War II, there, we were fighting the Axis, which was Japan, Germany, and Italy.
Okay.
And at the time, we thought, these guys are coordinating everything. They have some kind of master strategy, and we have to be careful because they're working together, and that's going to overwhelm us. Well, that wasn't the case at all. There was very little coordination, certainly between Germany and Japan. And Italy was a very weak ally that was, Mussolini was going off and doing all sorts of crazy things that made Hitler crazy. Whereas the Allies, the United States, the United Kingdom, Commonwealth nations, France, Canada, Poland, they were quite coordinated in their attacks. So we looked at the Axis and said, it's this huge monolithic movement. They're out to get us. Then during the Cold War, we looked at communism and said, communism is a world movement. It's what we called monolithic communism. It means that it's this one block that's moving to destroy everything in the West. We assume that the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, Central American countries, African countries, Southeast Asian countries were all getting their orders from the communist brain, and they were fighting to bring down the West. But what history has revealed is that was anything but the case. Lots of different flavors of communism. They didn't necessarily agree. You know, Nixon tried to play, figured out how to play China against the Soviet Union, exposed that there was a difference in their forms of communism. We tried to put pressure on the Chinese to solve the war in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese didn't care what the Chinese had to say. I mean, in the view of history, we look back at it and understand it wasn't monolithic. It was a viewpoint, but there were lots of different versions of it, and they did get along with each other. Now, here we are in the current era, and we're fighting radical Islam, right? Well, it's a billion people over all these different countries that are themselves more or less involved in a civil war for control of their movement, and it doesn't represent a single... There isn't one guy with a beard someplace in a cave that's pulling the triggers and fighting us in this war. It's a multi-front war against people that are almost as eager to fight each other as they are to fight us.
Mm.
But do you get any of that from Holy Terror?
No.
No.
It's just stabbing at them. Just poking it with a stick, basically.
Yeah.
And also, when this war's over, and it's been, you know, a couple decades, and we're going to look back at it the way we look back at World War II and understand it, we're going to look back at ourselves, and we're going to feel kind of foolish for stuff like this, as much as I enjoyed it. We're going to feel childish and immature for stuff like this when we'll have understood a better picture. And, you know, what it was... Right now, we're just living in terror. So we're going to make decisions on the spot, and we're just going to go, oh, that's the enemy. Let's go get them. And after a while, when the war's over, we're going to figure it out.
And it's a real thing. I mean, make no mistake. You know, you've got a cousin that's in the Marines.
Yeah, it's very real.
He's with the 13th Marine Expeditionary Force. He was floating around over there in the Straits of Hormuz. If this thing goes up, your cousin's going to be under fire.
Yeah.
And those aren't imaginary bullets coming his way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As we record this, there are revolts throughout the Arab world in India, Libya. Our embassy was overrun and burned. Our ambassador was just murdered in Libya. I mean, this is a real thing. And it's a serious thing. And it's maybe even something that can be addressed in comics. But maybe Holy Terror wasn't quite the way to approach it.
Maybe it's just not what we need.
I think it could have been what we need if it really was what I thought it was going to be, if it was going to be propaganda, if it was going to be cathartic, if it was Captain America punching Hitler. Okay, maybe that would be kind of fun. That would be more like Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is, I think, perfect for, you know, goofy propaganda, right?
Right, because Inglourious Basterds was kind of fun. It was a very serious subject. You can't get more serious than the Nazis, but you didn't think it was real.
No. Right? Very goofy.
All right, so do you think Quentin Tarantino understands what the Nazis were about?
No comment. I don't think so. I think he was just making a movie, and Tarantino, I mean, obviously, World War II is a very touchy subject for people still.
Yeah.
And I think it's been long enough. Then again, I wasn't alive during that time. And after a while, there will be no one alive during that time. So
yeah,
we're starting with, again, at this time where you can make kind of a goofy, almost action movie off of World War II.
Right.
I wasn't offended by it. And if I was Jewish, I also don't think I would be offended by it.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone was really offended by Inglourious Basterds, if, because it was just so overtly a revenge fantasy.
Yeah.
There was no attempt to... I mean, he hijacked the big elements of history. All right, there's a war, there are allies, there's Nazis, we're going to go take them out. But aside from that, he didn't really make any attempt to make us think it was a real thing.
No.
It's curious that I think Holy Terror is trying to hit a lot of the same buttons, but it wasn't as effective.
Just missing something.
Yeah. I can't quite put my finger on it. I mean, there's the aspects just of the storytelling where I think there are parts of it that are powerful, I guess, but I found it kind of confusing overall. I had a hard time following it.
Me too. I had to go back and reread pages.
And the dialogue doesn't snap. I mean, say what you will about Tarantino, but he can write dialogue.
Yeah.
It's riveting just to hear characters talk to each other, and here it doesn't really... It seemed like, Inglourious Basterds is full of conflict, not just people shooting and beating each other up. There's all sorts of conflict with characters talking to each other.
Yeah.
And here, is there any conflict? There's just kind of bloodshed, right? There's nobody that really stands up to the
Nothing
fixer.
Nothing evens it out.
Yeah, he just kind of cuts a swath, right? So I can't feel that he's threatened, and I guess I don't understand what he's fighting for. Just angry.
He's fighting because we're at war with them, and we have to hate them. That's what he's fighting for. It's, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know, kind of disappointing, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's okay to like it.
I did like it. I liked the way it was illustrated, despite some images being a little hard to see. I did like how it was kind of scribbled, and it did look desperate, like the time it takes place in.
Mm-hmm.
And I did feel like it ended a little bit suddenly, too.
Yeah.
It was just, go and get the bad guy and it's over.
Strange little coda. And then on the very end it says, dedicated to Theo van Gogh.
Filmmaker that was killed?
Yeah, a little bit about Theo van Gogh. So what do you know about him?
I just remember he was killed in the streets.
Yes.
I just know his name.
You know his name, and it's, with good reason. He's related to Vincent van Gogh. He's a great-grandnephew or something like that. He was a Dutch filmmaker, also, a columnist. And he was murdered for his views.
Yeah.
And that was unequivocal. There's no doubt that the man that killed him, I think he was a Dutch-Moroccan, he killed van Gogh because of his outspoken views against multiculturalism, also because of a movie he made that criticized the treatment of women in Muslim society.
What movie is that?
Actually, I don't have it at hand. I'm sorry, I don't know that right off the top of my head, but it was a movie that Muslims saw, or that this person at least saw, as being insulting to his religion. And he got van Gogh killed.
Yeah.
So it's, it's a real thing. And, do you think Frank Miller is taking a risk by doing this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know much history behind after he released it. I don't know if he received death threats. It's kind of strange. I'm surprised if he didn't receive death threats for it, I guess. But maybe since it's so... It's kind of goofy and short-minded. Maybe even Al-Qaeda didn't care.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know, but I don't recall hearing any death threats against Frank, aside from his American fans, maybe, that were disappointed in the quality of the work.
I mean,
the issue with not with Van Gogh necessarily, but with there was also a Dutch cartoonist that was killed because he had an image of Muhammad that he drew in a cartoon that people took offense to. One of the tenets of the Muslim faith is that Muhammad was a man. He was not divine. He was a man that brought the word of God. He was a prophet.
Yeah.
Brought the word of God to his people. And in his lifetime, Muhammad was adamant that he was not to be drawn. His picture was not to be made because Muhammad didn't want succeeding generations to worship him. He wanted them to worship God. He wanted them to worship Allah. So, don't you draw me. And don't you forget that God is the one true prophet, or the one true, Allah is the one true God, and I merely is his voice. And then Muhammad was a man who died, his body's buried, and he wasn't considered divine the way Christians look at Jesus. He was a man. So this manifests itself in Muslim society as being very touchy about any image of Muhammad.
Yeah.
Now, the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments tell us that you should make graven images of God. But that's kind of a different thing. It's more like, don't make an image and then worship it. But you can walk into a Catholic church and see pictures of Jesus.
Yeah.
Right? But for Muhammad, you're not to see any picture of him.
Yeah.
And to Muslim people, the mere suggestion that you would try to draw him or create an image of him is deeply offensive.
Yeah. That's why lots of controversy when South Park did it.
Yes.
With Trey Parker, Matt Stone, they did it. They received death threats.
Right.
And since... I don't quite remember, is Muhammad ever mentioned in this?
No, he's not.
You think that's why maybe they're not...
Now, there's a character named Muhammad. There's a scene where he's torturing one of the Al-Qaeda guys, and he says, I'm going to assume your name's Muhammad.
It's a lucky guess, right?
Right, and he's torturing him.
Yeah.
Right? But it's not Muhammad the Prophet.
Yeah.
It's just some miscellaneous guy whistled up out of Central Casting to be an evil terrorist.
Yeah.
So, then we'll wrap it up here, because we've gone on for a while, and I appreciate your thoughts, Miles. But I want to ask you one more thing. That's a torture scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about torture?
I grow up in a society where everyone's created equal, and we have human rights, and, it's illegal. I think it's wrong. And, there's times where I think, when if Osama was captured, I would have no problem if they tortured him,
mm-hmm.
even if I think it's wrong. I'm not quite sure how they treat our prisoners. I'm sure they've tortured their fair share of American soldiers, I still think torture is wrong, but then again, this is written in a really pissed off society, so we're gonna have fantasies about doing that to these guys.
Obviously, Fixer feels no remorse for torturing someone.
Yeah.
For him, it's just how much information can you get out of someone. It doesn't matter to him that what he's doing may be immoral.
Yeah. Also, a lot of Frank Miller's characters are torturers, and they have no problem with it.
I guess they really are.
Look at Sin City. So a lot of the characters do pretty horrible things, and they like it. Also, Batman and Robin likes it.
They ever make a mistake, those characters?
In what?
In Sin City. Is the hero ever rough up somebody that didn't deserve it?
Yeah.
Does that happen? Because I haven't read Sin City.
That happened in A Dame to Kill For.
So if somebody makes a mistake.
Yeah.
And then what happens to the character after that?
They regret it. They beats up the wrong guy. And it makes him turn on the girl.
I see. He was manipulated.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll see that in the newest Sin City movie coming out.
Yeah, like we're going to that.
Yeah, I'm going to that.
Yeah, well, you'll be old enough to drive yourself by the time it comes out. I won't see it. Torture is another debate that swirls around this particular subject. It's an ongoing debate. Do the ends justify the means? Is it right to torment or kill a few people to protect many people? I think we have Frank's answer.
Yes. He says yes.
He says yes. And in the context of a black and white comic book, maybe that makes sense.
But it's also a comic book world, and you can, things happen in it that make sense, wouldn't make sense. It's like, some movies, some books should be turned into movies. That's why, there's some problems with the Sin City movie where... it feels acceptable as a comic book, but, kind of as a movie, it's a little more, ridiculous.
It feels a little more immature.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work as well. Well, it's a complex issue, and maybe it's more complex than we should bite off tonight, but you reminded me of it when you mentioned Muhammad in that particular scene. So, any closing thoughts on Holy Terror?
I like it. I suggest you read it, whether or not you hate it, or, at least read it.
That's a freedom we have, right?
Yeah, you have freedom of speech, and I think it's worth reading, but don't expect anything too special. It's not going to uplift you. It's going to depress you, I guess, or it may leave no effect on you at all because it's really not that good, but I like it.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of movies that aren't that good that I like, so I can,
Well, what did you like about it? Tell me, give me a positive review here, because I've been kind of guiding you into criticism of this. I don't mean to, I guess I have. But I'm your dad, so I'm supposed to, right? I'm sorry to, impart or impress my opinions upon you, but tell me what you liked about Holy Terror.
I like the style of violence in it. It could work even without Al-Qaeda in it. I like the way Frank Miller illustrates violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like... I feel like this, since this wasn't his best story, didn't really have a middle peak in it that was super good, that set up like the last act. Most of his stuff had that, so that in that way it fails, and I was disappointed. But it felt a lot like Sin City. The illustrations, his style of writing is seen a lot, and maybe I like it, but I don't like it as propaganda. I like it as it's got some really amazing images in it. You know, you've got the Statue of Liberty falls in the water, mm-hmm. and you've got I just like all the black that appears in it.
Mm-hmm. It's like it as a Frank Miller action story.
Yeah, and maybe I don't like it as propaganda.
But given your druthers, you'd rather read Sin City.
Yeah, for sure.
And what do you think about this world you're growing up in, Miles? What's going to happen? What's going to happen tomorrow?
I think brutal things are happening every day, and I feel like it's kind of outweighing the good right now, and hopefully that'll change. I think the horrible things are so horrible that it outweighs the good right now. And, you know, on a scale, the good's, you know, at the top, and, you know, the bad is keeping it up. It's really ugly is what's happening.
Are you afraid?
Am I afraid? No, I don't. I don't plan on going in the military. I really don't want to. And if I'm drafted, I'll be afraid. I don't think we're going to come to that. But I feel like this war is very distant. I mean, if you look at the way our society's treating this war, it's kind of, you know, busload of soldiers gets blown up, gets moved to page 7. And we've got, crap no one cares about on page 1, you know. Mm-hmm. Or actually everyone cares about for some reason. And I feel like people are kind of just wanting to ignore the war because we're just really upset about it.
I'm tired of it, maybe.
We're tired of it. People just want to pretend it's not happening. And I feel like when it ends, let's say we win and it ends, I don't think we're really going to feel much of a victory.
It's already lasted longer than World War II, you know.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's really, really pathetic. I think wars are something that the human race will never actually get out of. You know, we may evolve, but I don't think the human race will ever move out of war and violence and hate. But I think we will figure out how to channel it better.
But do you feel safe in your country? Do you feel safe when you're riding the train to school? Do you feel safe when you're flying in an airplane?
Maybe airplanes I feel a little frightened on.
I think a whole generation will always be
traumatized. I still feel scared on an airplane. I don't feel scared when I'm riding a train into school. I don't feel scared when I'm sleeping at night. No, I'm not scared. And then again, if I was scared, I'd be letting the terrorists win. And I don't want them to win, so mm-hmm. I'm not going to be scared.
That's a handy bit of propaganda. It's a good kind. Well, I mean, it encapsulates what we should and should not allow people to do or feel about things. And I think that's kind of what Miller was getting to on the very last page, where his character, who's not Commissioner Gordon, is waking up in the middle of the night, and he's hearing the clock ticking. He's got this haunted look on his face. It's like, get on with your life, or don't let the terrorists win. Don't be afraid.
Yeah.
Be yourself, right? Because it's an irony that, and it's hard because you can't prove a negative, you know. And it is a real war, and we do have security people that are doing things to keep our country and our people safe. We don't know what would have happened in this country if they hadn't done what they'd done.
Yeah.
But the truth is, in the last 10 years, you've got as much or more to fear from some crazy white guy running amok with a gun.
Yeah.
As you do from Islamic terrorists on American soil. It's different if you're in Africa or the Middle East or something. Very different experience. But here, I mean, you were closer to being whacked when we went to go see a midnight show of Batman than you are from any machinations of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, it's a very distant problem right
now. Yeah, because, you know, we're in Southern California. These poor devils got shot up in a Colorado movie theater, but we were at a midnight showing of Batman. We felt a certain kinship there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this knucklehead in Wisconsin that shot up a Sikh temple, because apparently anybody that's not white and has a towel on their head is someone that you're supposed to go fight.
You know?
Sikhs have nothing to do with...
I feel scared for many different reasons. You know, I walk around in a not-so-good part of town on my way to school, and, you know, there's always a chance of getting jumped there, but I'm more scared of that than I am of Al-Qaeda, you know, bombing a train, you know, a couple stops into school. It's just...
Right. But, so a book like Holy Terror didn't make you feel better, necessarily, or safer.
No.
Didn't teach you anything or give you insight about what might be happening.
It feels like it's just Frank Miller super angry right now and wants to share with the world. Right. I'm that way when I write screenplays. I'll write stuff that only makes sense to me and other people will frown upon, and that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, this has been Frank's only work for the last
yeah
4 or 5 years. That just by itself is kind of disappointing.
Right? Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe he'll come out with something else that'll really impress me. You know, I'm still open to liking him, and yeah. I was not completely, you know, I don't think this is terrible at all. I'm disappointed, but I don't think it's terrible. I'm close to that. I think it's good, but it's just not what it is. It's just not as good as what it should have been.
Yeah.
And I hope to see more from him.
You're a good guy, Miles.
Thanks.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts. All right, and thanks to the Longbox Graveyard audience for this somewhat longer show than normal. Different format. Won't always be like this, but I thought it was worth, rather than just doing a Holy Terror review, which would have been me pontificating. And you got some of that, too. But thanks, Miles, for giving me a different perspective.
Yep.
All right, let's wrap things up here real quick. It's time for the plug of the month. We do this every month at Longbox Graveyard. We talk about something that somebody else is doing that we admire, that we think you should check out. This month, it's for a website. It's comicosity.com, comicosity.com. Comicosity.com is a sponsor of many of the podcasts on the We Talk podcast network. It's not a sponsor of the Longbox Graveyard podcast. I just like the site. It's a fine news site. It's run by a heck of a guy, Aaron Long. Aaron's interesting. He's a lapsed reader. He read comics for a long time and then got away from them. He got back into comics 3 years ago, and now he's in with both feet. He's running his own news site. He did a 10 Tweets Thursday with me a couple months ago, which was a lot of fun. You'll find that on the site. There's also a link on Longbox Graveyard. His site is primarily focused on new books, so that's less interesting to me, but it's still a very nice site. It's worth visiting. It's worth being part of your RSS subscriptions if that's what you do. Plus, Aaron is an Astros fan, so he could really use some cheering up right now. So check out his site. Tell him Longbox Graveyard sent you. You can find him at www.comicosity.com. Another plug this month, also for me. Last month in the Digital Comics and Illusion of Ownership blog, I talked about how I want to get rid of things. I'm surrounded by piles of books. I want to get rid of them. I want to sell them. I've had very little luck selling them on eBay. So I am basically giving them away. I am giving them away to you, my loyal Longbox Graveyard readers, more or less for the cost of postage. I'm shoving 80 comics at a time into a flat rate box and mailing it to anybody who wants them. It costs you $20, which is $13 for postage and $7 for my dignity, which seems a and Miles laughs, thank you, which seems a fair price to pay. So go to the blog and look. There'll be a tab there that says Almost Free Comics. Click on that. That's where all the details are. So far, I've sold 3 boxes of 1990s Marvel comic books. And a couple boxes of indie comics, and I'm going to continue to put these things up in lots of 80. They're random, but they're good stuff, and it's better than throwing them in the street, and it makes you guys happy to get these boxes. So buy some of my comics. I'm not making any money. I just got to get them out of my house. So check the blog for the Almost Free Comics tab and buy some of my comic books. Where to find me? All the usual places. You know, there's a Longbox Graveyard page on Facebook, on Google+. You can find me on Twitter as @LBoxGraveyard. I'm on Pinterest as Longbox Graveyard. I'm on Tumblr. Also on Instagram as Longbox_Graveyard. I'm having a lot of fun on Instagram. Please look me up these places. I invite your comment and your feedback. Of course, you can always find me at the blog, www.longboxgraveyard.com. And one more bit of time-sensitive information. As I record this, it's the middle of September. In October, I think it's the second week of October, I'm going to be in Austin, Texas. I'm going to be speaking at the Game Developers Conference there in Austin. I'll only be in town 3 or 4 days. It's going to be very busy. But, you know, if there are any listeners in Austin you'd like to get together, you know, shoot me a mail. Maybe we can arrange to meet up for a lunch or a drink or something. It'd be nice to meet you in person. I understand there's some good comic shops I should check out in Austin, too. It's still a month out. I don't know what my schedule is going to be like. But if you're in Austin and you want to get together, contact me. Write me, email me. Contact me on Twitter and maybe we can get together. So that's it. This has been a long show. I appreciate your patience. Going to wrap it up. Next month we'll be back with more conventional format. We'll talk about comic books and technology. Thanks to Mo Christensen and the We Talk Comics crew for engineering the show. All the many readers of my blog, listeners of this podcast, thank you, Miles.
Thank you for listening, too.
For some insight. I really appreciate you being a sport and coming on and sharing your thoughts. That's it. So thanks again for listening, everybody. And until next month, I will see you in the funny papers.
This is the first time we've sung together in about 9 years, maybe 10.
It's been a long time.
It's just so great to be here this evening. There's a tune I did back in the mid-60s that kind of was a benchmark for me. I had no idea it was going to do what it did. Went all over the world. Became a number one tune in the States. I still sing it because the song is more valid today than it was when it was first recorded in 1965. The song had no answers, but it had a lot of very honest questions in it. So we just thought we'd sing it first here to establish the questions. And then the rest of the evening, between me and Don and Wendy, we hope to reveal the answers that we found in our walk and where God has led us in our lives. And hopefully it will encourage others to taste and see. But this is the song that's more valid now than it was then. Now the Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets load. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war. I want that gun you took, and even the Jordan River has bodies floating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, saying you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. And now you don't believe, no, no. Hell, I know you understand what I'm trying to say. I know you feel the fears, I'm still feeling them today. When the button is pushed, there'll be no running away. Well, there'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, saying you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction, yeah. And now you don't believe, no, 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 no. Well, my blood's so mad, it's like coagulating. I'm standing here just contemplating. You can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. And a handful of senators can't pass legislation and marches along will never bring integration. When human respect is a disintegrating, how this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, saying you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. And now you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Well, think of all the hate there is in Red China. Then take a look around to the Taliban, Al-Qaeda. How we can leave here for 6 months in space, but when we return, it's the same old place. Yeah, the pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. We can bury our dead and not leave a trace. Hate our next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. And now you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.